You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, January 2nd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape just steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It is the final of our best ofs from 2014. Even though we're in 2015, there's no reason why you can't do best ofs from 2014. In fact, if there's any argument, the real weird thing is, how can you do best ofs of 2014 in 2014? If you were going to take issue with this, ladies, gentlemen, you should have done it on Monday and Tuesday of this week and Wednesday of this week. Not now. Straw man, you say? Yeah, maybe. Maybe actually you were taking issue with it and I've been on vacation and I wouldn't even know about it. Regardless, it's our final best of day. We've had a great week of best ofs. This interview with Professor Eddie Gloud is not as dry and policy-oriented as some of the other ones this week. I interviewed Professor Gloud. Well, I've been interviewing him for years. I quite enjoy him as a guest. But I had interviewed him when I was doing the 3 to 6 briefly over the course of 2014. I was doing a terrestrial radio show. You all know the story about that. It fell apart when they announced to me 6 weeks into it that they could not pay me until well past this date. So in mid to early July, they said, hey, you know, we've done revised projections on our revenue, and it appears that we won't be able to pay you till January of 2015. And so late January 2015, that's the best case scenario. And that's when I said goodbye. But before I did say goodbye, I interviewed Professor Eddie Gloud. I think it was to mark the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. And on terrestrial radio, you don't have the opportunity you do on, like on this show, to really get into something. And so we had a good interview on that show, but we had started to move into territory about issues of white supremacy and that were fascinating to me. And so we had him back on about a month and a half later. And by that point, we were talking about what had taken place in Ferguson at that time in August. Obviously this year, so much of what we have been talking about has been centered around in some shape or another, white supremacy, and particularly as in regards to, you know, policing. But I'm not sure that's – we were so focused on policing with Eddie Gloud. But if you're interested in this stuff, I mean, some of what we spoke about just fairly recently on this program is relevant in terms of – in terms of guests and whatnot, but I think you're going to enjoy this quite a bit. You know, some of what I think has come up in terms of the policing, you can see in the interview that we did just a couple of weeks ago with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, when she talks about an indigenous people's history of the United States and how, in some ways, our treatment of natives in this country became a template. But so enjoy this interview with Professor Eddie Gloud, and Matt, as usual, will put some nuggets for you at the end of, after the interview from our better half, our funner half, as we like to call it around here. And remember, you can become a member by becoming by going to majority.fm and clicking on Join the Majority Report, become a member. Or you can go jointhemajorityreport.com if you, you're one of those people who like to go to a specific URL. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 10% off. We use the coupon code MAJORITY. But all that and more, your support is what makes this show possible. And we will be back just now 3 short days from today. I mean, not really today, because I'm actually recording this, you know, weeks before now. But just days from today, as you listen to this, on Monday the 5th, we'll be back. Me, Matt, if he survived his cold, and Michael, if he survived, you know, I don't know, all the wine bars that he probably toured on his vacation. Folks, we will see you on Monday, and enjoy this interview with Professor Eddie Glaude. Happy New Year. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the chair of the Center of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of the forthcoming Democracy in Black, How Race Still Governs the Soul of America. I guess that's coming out in 2015. Professor Eddie Glaude, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Sam.
Now, we spoke, I guess it was about a month ago or so, on the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, and we started to talk about a lot of issues, I think, that really are in play with what has happened in Ferguson, and there are so many issues involved in what we've seen. Starting with the shooting of Michael Brown, and then with the police response, and frankly the political response. Just give me your thoughts up front of what we've seen there.
Well, I mean, it's been an unmitigated disaster on every level. And I think it's important, Sam, to just make explicit what I think is underneath what has happened in Ferguson and what has been happening throughout the country. And that is, in the United States, contrary to our stated principles, there is an operating and ongoing practice in which certain people's lives are valued more than others. And when I say certain people's lives, I'm being a bit generous here. It is the case that if you're white, if you're rich, and if you're male, your life, and if you're straight, your life is valued more than others who are not. And we see that in the way in which communities are policed, and we see that specifically in Ferguson. When you talk about what the town of 21,000 people, 67% are black, one out of four who live in Ferguson live below the federal poverty level, which means that they make less than $24,000 a year. And you see that the consistent experience of a community that is over-policed, that is constantly under surveillance, and don't feel a sense of protection. So there's economic vulnerability. There's a sense of being occupied by a police force that doesn't represent them in terms of the idea of serving and protecting the community. There's a lack of representation in city governance. And so what you have is a population that is, for the most part, marginalized from the daily operations of democratic life in this country, a population many of whom lack the resources to imagine a good life for themselves and for their children. And so when you have the tragedy of Michael Brown, the obvious murder of Michael Brown, no wonder we are experiencing what we're experiencing in Ferguson.
I mean, it's been frustrating to me on some level to watch, you know, the reporting and the coverage of this, because on some level there's an element of, I don't know. I mean, I guess someone has called it conflict porn. And that's an element of it. And then there's also the sort of the obsessive parsing of what will happen legally to this cop who, you know, I think by the opinion of many people I've read and talked to seem to think that, you know, very hard to be able to prosecute a cop in this situation because they have basically because of this dynamic, I guess, that exists. And very little talk and discussion about that aspect of just of this being an ongoing problem, that that what has happened with Michael Brown is really sort of the tip of the iceberg in some way, just peering out of the water. And there's really not been a national attempt to look below the surface.
Right, right. And, you know, I mean, I think Bob Herbert has a piece now out in Demos where he talks about the theater around these sorts of events, and nothing changes, nothing happens. He was talking about, you know, the surprise that America expresses, that white America expresses when they're confronted with what, for all intents and purposes, is the horror of living particular kinds of lives in particular sorts of places. And he invokes Katrina, you know, oh my God, you know, Katrina literally washes up into the, you know, into the sight of the broader country or the nation, what people are living daily, right? And we're going, that can't happen in America, right? And so here we are, again with Ferguson, and people are asking the question, how can this happen in America when in fact it's happening day in and day out? Right, it's happening every single day. I mean, if we were to go down the line, I mean, just in this month alone, Sam, how many people have been killed by the police? Eric Garner, Ezell Ford. I mean, we could just Michael Brown. I mean, we can just keep going, right? And then, of course, there's Kendrick Johnson, there's Renisha McBride, there's Jonathan Farrell, there's Jordan Davis, there's Trayvon Martin, there's Marlene Pinnock, who was just brutally beaten by a California Highway Patrol person. People are surprised, and then we have the conflict porn, as you so powerfully put it. Then you have the entertainment corporate media driving this, and no one is really looking at the root causes. And the root causes is that there's a congenital disease that distorts this country, and that congenital disease is white supremacy.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I wanted to actually talk about that because, you know, when we spoke on the anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, it is something that when you talk about white supremacy being a through line through our politics from really in the founding of this country, and it was a little bit revelatory for me because on some level I think. I have always perceived this issue of race as being specific to non-whites, as opposed to seeing it from the perspective of it really is ultimately about providing supremacy for a very specific and I think one could argue historically white male supremacy. And if you perceive it through that lens, things make a lot more sense as the way to break things down, I guess.
It's hard for people to hear the phrase white supremacy and not think of people running around in hoods, white hoods, and burning crosses in yards, or putting up Nazi, swastikas or the like. But white supremacy is really about the belief and the practice that white people ought to be valued more than non-white people. And we tend to think about that as holding a racist belief, when in fact it can be evidenced in the very social arrangements that organize our lives. So who has access to the best schools? Who has access to inherited wealth? Who has access to the best jobs? Who has, we have to understand as well, Brother Sam, is that white supremacy is not just simply the ideology of white people, right? It's a practice that I can participate in, that President Obama can be the head of, can participate in. And so part of, and in the background that's in my head is, this wonderful moment in James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time where he says, as long as we've been, I'm paraphrasing here, as long as we believe we're a white nation in the vein of Europe, we will never achieve our country. And so part of the challenge is that, really quickly, another study says that, people believe that, racial equality is a zero-sum game, that as black folk gain more access to American life, many white respondents believe that they lose, right, benefits and resources. So when you have this view of racial equality as a zero-sum game, then we understand what the stakes are, right? We understand what the stakes are. And now we have this wonderful, wonderfully efficient ideological frame to blame the very people who are locked out and marginalized for their own marginalization, right? Let's make Michael Brown a thug. Let's make him a criminal. Let's give an account of the culture of poverty that has produced these people who don't warrant the kind of respect and dignity that we would accord to others, if that makes sense to you.
Yes, there's two things I want to touch on there, but this notion of white supremacy being a practice at one point, I guess Nelly had spoken about and engaged in what one writer, and I cannot remember, but the politics of respectability,
right?
And this notion, and we have seen a lot about this, and we spoke about this briefly and didn't get into it, but the making sort of poverty a pathology. We see this practice adopted on some level, not just by the Paul Ryans out there, but on some level also by President Obama. I mean, talk about draw this out for us, this notion of it being a practice, the politics of respectability, which is sort of the mirror image of that practice of white supremacy.
Right. So when we talk about white supremacy as a practice, what we're talking about is the very ways in which our social arrangements, right, orient us to one another in such a way that the basic claim that some people are valued more than others are lived out in our choices. Now, that's kind of abstract, but let's kind of make it concrete. So there's a way in which most states fund schools, right, by local neighborhoods. Right. I mean, so we know how schools are funded, right, through property taxes. But we know that residential segregation, right, is thick, right, in the United States. And there was a deliberate effort to undermine efforts at coming out of the 1960s to really desegregate housing in the United States and neighborhoods. And so even though schools are funded by way of property taxes, and even though we know that residential segregation is rampant in the United States, we still are comfortable with making the choice that some people can go to bad schools and some people can't go to bad schools. Now, some people can go to good schools. And that you don't have to be Bull Connor, right, to hold that view. You can just say, I want my kid to go to the best schools, right? And holding that view, you still perpetuate, right, the inequality that is rampant in the country. Now, at the same time that those choices are being made, right, I just want my kid to go to the best school, we need to live in a safe neighborhood, which means we leave these other people living in less than safe neighborhoods and going to bad schools, right? We can then say those people who attend those bad schools and those people who live in those bad neighborhoods live in those circumstances because of their behavior. It's not because of any choices that I'm making. I'm not deliberately racist, right? It's because their behavior is such that they don't exhibit, right, the wherewithal, the individual motivation to make themselves better. They just want government handouts. They're welfare babies, you know, welfare women and mothers, right? Their children are undisciplined, and Obama will say they're feeding them Popeyes for breakfast. With no mention of the fact that they're food deserts, right? Or they're not really performing in school with no real mention that there are 40 people in the classroom with an untrained teacher in front of them. So part of what we're saying is that when we think about white supremacy as a practice, we're not talking about people running around calling people the N-word or burning crosses. We're talking about the very way in which our society is organized, which reproduces benefits for particular people, right, and marginalizes others, right, because of just simply where they were born and the color of their skin. And then you have folks like me and folks like Obama, Brother Sam, who we can gain access to mainstream American life, right? And then we become the billboard for the inclusion, the inclusiveness of American life, when in fact we're as stratified and segregated as we've ever been. Does that make sense?
Yes, and also, I mean, just it, generally speaking, for and I think, you know, this has been argued, you know, I think in both a critical and supportive way of President Obama, at least, that he has either as an individual or as the president has an inability to do anything other than to accept that practice on some level. You know, some time ago, I spoke to Randall Kennedy, and he wrote the Persistence of the Color Line, and I think that was sort of his argument on some level that, and in fact, I saw a piece as to why President Obama, when he addressed what was going on in Ferguson, was never going to please, you know, his supporters, I guess, or people who had anticipated more from him, I mean, break that down for us a little bit, because, you know, the argument I saw, for instance, by Ezra Klein was that, well, the White House knows at this point that anything they come out for actually creates more polarization. And so he just thought it was best for him to sit on the sidelines. Give me your take on that.
But, you know, Sam, that's so powerful in what it reveals. Right? I mean, to make that claim, for Klein to make that claim, or for Randy to make that claim, we're basically saying, without saying it explicitly, that we're a deeply racist society. And so to the extent to which Obama or any of us speak directly, right, to racial disparity, to the fact that this police officer shot an 18-year-old kid, killed him, used deadly force, unarmed, right, the fact that we want to call attention to the racial dimensions, right, of the militarization of policing in this country would generate and activate, right, a kind of white backlash, would activate white fears, right, and it would polarize us even more. That's just a nice way of saying if Obama says this, it will give license to people to express racist views. So then the remedy to that is to not say anything directly about it, which in the end achieves what? It leaves all of it in place.
Right.
So it's a deadly circuit and cycle. And I've made the claim that if we continue to dance the dance of white supremacy, it will always continue to organize our lives. If I'm worried about activating the fear of my white interlocutor, right, and that leads me to repress right, the very nature of the kind of hail that I'm catching, then I leave in place the conditions for the hail. And this is what infuriates me with Obama. He refuses to change the frame. And then the excuse, right, is that he cannot do otherwise. Right? He cannot be otherwise. And that, to me, is a fatalist position which suggests that America will always be this kind of place.
Right, and it basically says that you really need a white guy if anybody can raise this type of issue. But even then, right, the argument remains the same. I mean, at one point, it has to be addressed. I mean, you know, to me, one of the most sort of shocking things about the aftermath of this, I mean, there's two mm-hmm. things that have stayed. One is the idea that a police force could go into an 80% white neighborhood or town in the country, 70%, 60% white neighborhood even, mm-hmm. dressed like that with that type of gear. And then on top of it, and for some reason this just sort of just sticks out at me, without wearing their badges and their name tags, that they could do that is just, it is easier for me to imagine we just move the entire country and live on the moon. It is just impossible to imagine that that would stand. And the idea
Absolutely.
That nobody seems to, and this is what is just shocking to me, the idea that even that Holder, I mean, who is theoretically the chief, not theoretically, he is the chief law enforcement officer in the country, is mm-hmm. not saying this practice must stop right now, is... They need to identify themselves as police officers, and it's not enough to be wearing body armor to do so, it seems
right.
to me.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Doc. I mean, it's mind-blowing. And if people can't acknowledge that point or concede that point, they're being disingenuous.
On some level, I'm just speaking to this sort of the complete lack of leadership here. I mean, how does mm-hmm. the federal government not be more proactive, at least rhetorically? I mean, really draw the lines of what has been crossed here.
They're walking on eggshells, man. And, you know, I had an interesting, a testy exchange on Twitter with Goldie Taylor about this. And, you know, she was making the claim that we were demanding too much of Obama, and did we, in terms of responding to the situation, in terms of the criticisms of the second press conference, and that did we make the same kinds of demands with regard to Sean Bell and James Byrd and Abner Louima and the like. And of course, I believe that there were demands, but these situations aren't analogous, right? 9 days of civil unrest didn't follow in some ways. In the same way, right? But the point is, and I remember asking this question, saying, why is it unreasonable for black people to expect more from Obama? Why is that considered unreasonable? And why is it the case that Obama can't speak directly, right, to what is happening in Ferguson? Michael Bell came on the heels of Eric Garner. Ezell Ford was murdered in L.A., right? The young man in an open and carry state in Walmart was shot down, all within the matter of 1 month. And we have no mention of the nature of policing, right? No mention of the nature of policing vis-a-vis this particular community directly, right? And at that point, you know, you just kind of say, okay, this is not only a double standard, this is where we are. This is what America is. You know, it's like what my great-grandmother used to say to me, when people show you who they are, believe them.
Right. I mean, I saw an interview I don't know if it was Don Lemon or Jake Tapper, somebody on CNN, mm-hmm. was interviewing a woman who had claimed that she had had a run-in with Wilson a month prior to Michael Brown being shot.
Where, I saw that interview, yep.
Where I guess she was pepper sprayed, and he refused. He didn't. There was no. She was not charged. She was not arrested. There was nothing happened. But he just refused to allow anyone around her to pour milk in her eyes. Mm-hmm. And there was confusion by whoever it was that was interviewing. Like, oh, did this happen during these protests? And she's like, no, this happened a month ago. And right. That, to me, is also the story that's not being told. For every black man who is being killed by police, an unarmed black man who's being killed by police, how many, literally hundreds, if not thousands, and, you know, when we look at Stop and Frisk in New York City, I mean, how many thousands or tens of thousands of times are black people being subjected to just some form of police abuse? And what that does to just your perception being in society, knowing that the one group that is literally specifically supposed to protect and serve you is doing exactly the opposite.
Right. I mean, just look at Ferguson as a case study. I mean, in 2003, there were 24,532 arrest warrants issued to black people.
I mean,
that's three per household. 86% of the stops by cops in the town of Blackfoot. Right. When we begin to drill down in the data, you're talking about a community that's over-policed, a community that's constantly under surveillance, right? And so, I mean, even with the Eric Garner case, I mean, when we look at the video footage, what do we see? Officer, every time I see you, you're harassing me about selling cigarettes.
Right.
And it's like, every time I see you, you're harassing me. I'm just not going to – and it's like, as if he was saying, I just can't take it anymore. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. I'm not selling cigarettes. This is what he's saying. And the next thing you know, he's in a chokehold that kills him. Right? And so there's a sense in which we're, as a nation, we're comfortable with a certain form of policing, right, that infringes upon the liberties of a particular segment of the population. Right? You know, elsewhere in the country, people have, the notion of liberty has supplanted the idea of justice. People are more committed to liberty than they are to justice. But in this instance, they're not. They're saying it's okay to police in this way. It's okay to presume guilt as opposed to innocence vis-a-vis certain people with certain bodies who live in certain communities, right? It's okay to infringe upon their freedom. And it's happening day in and day out. And then on top of that, I'm sorry, I'm getting kind of emotional about it. On top of that, can you imagine a police officer? And I grew up in a household in which I was told how to behave with the police. For my life, it was a life lesson, right? Because you get killed. This was my dad telling me. And could you imagine, as you try to engage respectfully with a police officer, that the way in which he or she talks to you is demeaning, is degrading, doesn't accord you dignity, is cussing at you, roughing you up? Right. And then you could have not done anything. There's the threat of arrest. Right. And then they'll just lock you up and just put you there and then release you with no charge. Right. So this is daily. And then people are shocked when people are just, I've had enough. Leave me alone. Why are they at risk of resisting arrest? Why don't they respect authority? Right. I mean, come on, man. At some point, damn.
And at the very least, I mean, I think the reason I think we have seen such persistence by the protesters in Ferguson is because this has been one of, it seems to me, I mean, you know, I've seen suggestions that, you know, what the people of Ferguson should be doing is organizing and voting for a recall of their city officials and this idea that people could be subjected to this type of, you know, where they are literally being stared down by a, you know, there's no other way to really describe it, but this sort of paramilitary force. And that really what they've got to do is orient themselves more towards the election box. I mean, I think this opportunity for the people of Ferguson to at least have one mode of expression. And,
right.
it, you know, it's almost like created this this zone, at least, where they're having one opportunity to be heard, at least to some degree, I imagine must be somewhat cathartic. I mean, to just literally to have this opportunity. I mean, there's been some good reporting on the ground where people have had the opportunity to sort of express what's going on there. It just seems that no one hears that beyond a certain sphere, that it gets sort of mediated. And by the time we hear the president talk about it, it really comes down to just sort of let's let the process work. Well, it's quite clear the process is not working.
Exactly. And, you know, what's beautiful about it is that there are organizers on the ground, local organizers on the ground, who are mapping out a strategy, who are mapping out a plan to pursue and to address the more structural concerns that undergird this amazingly powerful moment. I should say just as an aside, I think this is Obama's Katrina, and I think Ferguson will be as important for this generation and their political sensibility as Obama's election in 2008, in terms of shifting, waking up from this sleepwalking that was induced in 2008. But I think what on the ground there are efforts. I see them. I talk with folk on a regular basis. There are efforts to really imagine a new kind of politics that's not beholden to the old black liberal consensus narrative, right? I mean, we've heard about Jesse Jackson being booed. Al Sharpton has been booed, right? We see that traditional constituency out there looking towards the ballot box, saying only 12% of black folk turned out to vote in the last election. This is, you know, then they get castigated with no analysis, right, of what this alienation from the political process might suggest other than just simply black folk being lazy politically. And so I think you hit the nail right on the head. This is a form of political expression that's messy. Democracy is messy. It challenges a certain kind of commitment to law and order. But it's also challenging, right, certain set of arrangements that I think run counter to democratic life. So it has amazing political potential. And we need to think about what happened post the riots in Watson 65, right? The kinds of policies that followed. There was a kind of increase in the quality of black life in some ways. But since then, what, black wages have been stagnant. The economic collapse, which is a Great Depression in the black community since 2008, Ferguson is happening in a particular moment in which the crisis has come to a head. In black America, and the nation is going to have to confront it, just plain and simple.
I want to just,
sure.
Towards the end of our last interview, we got cut off, but you were talking about this new sort of reimagining the politics, sort of a, and you quoted Reverend Barber from the Moral Mondays movement down in North mm-hmm. Carolina is talking about a third reconstruction. And I think at that time you were talking about it as an examination of the sort of destructive force of neoliberalism and capitalism to a certain degree, and mm-hmm. race being a multiplier in terms of suffering for those who are losers in the sort of neoliberal structure. And mm-hmm. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wrote a piece in Time saying that Ferguson's not just about systemic racism, but it is about class warfare to some extent. Talk about that nexus. I don't know if you read that piece, but
yeah, I did. I did read the piece, and you know, I think you know, it's always troublesome, even with all the insight of the piece. It's always troublesome when there is this kind of insistence that one or the other has to be the
right.
principal causal driver of outcomes, right? Where it has to be either class or it has to be race. What we have to see in this moment is the interpenetration of both, right? Where class and race are interacting in such a way that it's producing and reproducing these sorts of outcomes that require us to be much more subtle and nuanced in our analysis. What we do know is clear that race and poverty interact in such a way that exacerbates the experience of marginalization. Right? What does it mean to be black and poor in a neoliberal context is pretty horrifying in its particulars. And so what we have to do, I think, Brother Sam, is really wrap our minds around the way in which neoliberalism trades in race in producing outcomes. And what do I mean by that? That is to say, there are particular populations that are disposable populations. And neoliberalism is content with that. And whether they can kind of contain them, right, in hyper-concentrated neighborhoods of poverty where resources don't circulate, or whether they will incarcerate them and make money off of them, right, by using incarcerated labor to produce profits for private enterprise. What we see very clearly is the very way in which what was talked about in the 80s as the black underclass, right, has experienced an extraordinary descent into darkness over the last 4 to 5 to 6 years. In fact, it's been decades in the making, right, with the disappearance of manufacturing industry, with the shrinking of government, both of which were the principal avenues to black middle-class life in this country. So we need to have a really in-depth analysis of the way in which capital is working, the way in which capitalism has reorganized itself, in my view. But we need to also understand that race must figure in that analysis because white supremacy is still working even as capital is seeking profit.
Does that make sense? Yeah, and I think actually viewing it as white supremacy makes it much easier conceptually to understand how that works there. Because, I mean, ultimately, if you are the one, if you are holding the chalice of white supremacy, and you necessarily the most effective at sort of that practice will be the wealthiest white people, right? Mm-hmm. And those with the most social power. And at that point, things begin to fall into place as to who's going to be the lowest on the totem pole. Not necessarily in terms of a plan, but sort of as a function of the way neoliberalism operates. If you have that notion in mind that it is sort of a practice of white supremacy, things begin to line up. You know, white people are there to make sure that they're a buffer between poor black people and white rich people on some
right.
level.
I mean, and you know, and the thing is that, you know, we can look at how that works just simply paying attention to the figures around the white black-white wealth gap, right? The way in which inherited wealth is working in this new economy, and the way in which black folk, people of color, are figured in that calculus, right? I mean, one of the things we do know is that the principal form of wealth for black communities has been historically owning homes, and we do know one of the devastating consequences of the crisis of 2008. Was the racialized dimension of the housing crisis. And what we saw what we've seen since 2008, Brother Sam, is that the gains in wealth in the 90s have just simply been wiped out in black America, just wiped away. Right? So, and you have to understand that in relation to what were the principal reasons that blocked our access to wealth. And it has something to do with the fact that white supremacy has been such a crucial ideology organizing this country. And I want to say this, too. Just as I want to say that white supremacy is a practice, I also want to suggest that freedom is a practice. Freedom is not an end. You know, it's not just something you sing and march for and then you say, boom, we got it. No, freedom is a practice. It's evident in the way in which we act and in the way in which we go about navigating the world. And so freedom is an ongoing aim and ambition, right? in the context of arrangements that in some ways seek to thwart our efforts, if that makes sense.
And, you know, I just wanted to there was a stat that just jumped out at me in some of the reading I've been doing that and I think it was from Brookings, but it says that for a white family, every dollar of income turns into $5 of wealth. For the typical African-American family, $1 translates into 69 cents of wealth. In other words, we're also seeing, particularly in the past 15 to 20 years, that the rate in which that mobility is working backwards for black people in this country, that if you are born in sort of a median income and you're white, the chances of the kids out earning the parents is something like 65%. It goes the opposite direction if you're black.
Right.
And that's a dramatic change from the 25 years or so, or 30 years following the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah. I mean, you hit it on the head. I mean, and when you have that kind of data in front of you, and of course we could marshal all sorts of other data, right? It becomes hard to not say what we've been saying over the course of our conversation today, right? That we have to confront this fundamental claim that some people are valued more than others. Some people's lives in this country are valued more than other people's lives. Some people's children's future are cherished more than other people's children's future, right? And we have to interrogate what that means and how that does not square with our conception of ourselves as a beacon of democratic life, right? I mean, my colleagues here at Princeton they've already made the headlines by saying that the U.S. is no longer a democracy; it's an oligarchy, right? But part of my work, and I think our work, Sam, is to really understand as carefully as we can what stands in the way of achieving our country. What blocks the way? And Ferguson is a wonderful example of this. What blocks the way? Right? It's our refusal. It's the nation's refusal to accord dignity and standing to all of its citizens, to all of its people. And there are reasons why that's the case, because people can get rich off of having disposable populations in their midst. Right? But I think we have to just, I mean, the data you just laid out and the other data, and people will dismiss it. And when they dismiss it, you just kind of say, okay, how can I say that beyond saying this is disingenuous, how can I say that I can't have the conversation that we need to have with you because you're stuck in this thing? You're just denying the reality of the matter. But it's hard.
Right. Well, Professor Eddie Gloud, Chair of the Center of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of the forthcoming, I Can't Wait, Democracy in Black, How Race Still Governs the Soul of America. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. You have a great one.
You too.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where the truth comes to party. The left has never been so right. Or so sexy. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services? You know who you gotta see. Cliff Schachter,
LLC. It's always about this sort of this culture for the conservatives, but it is sometimes shrouded in some type of economic message. Paul Ryan spoke to the CPAC audience, and he's come out with his report that purports to show that the war on poverty was ineffective. And, of course, citing this time a bunch of academic studies where nearly every person cited in his report has said, he miscited me, essentially. He picked and chose certain parts of the report and didn't actually give what we actually found, which, of course, you know, apparently somehow he is inoculated from any type of accountability. I mean, in some ways, Paul Ryan is his own walking Benghazi. No way. He's never accountable. But
he is just a walking sort of Benghazi combined with an IRS testimony being given in front of Daryl Issa. You know, it's so true, though. It's that culture of where Daryl Issa can make a statement, as he did, you know, with Elijah Cummings, and then after his statement is made, the rebuttal to point out that what he's saying is completely false, you shut down the microphone. That's what Paul Ryan is.
Now,
he's a shutdown microphone.
I want people to listen. We've got a significant, I mean, it's a fairly long clip of Paul Ryan, and we will stop this. I think this is sociopathic, but listen to Paul Ryan retell this story about a kid who gets free lunches at school. This is the vision of this guy. Well, let's just play.
We are going to show the country that there is a better way. You know, the way I see it, let the other party be the party of personalities. We will be the party of ideas.
Pause it. Yeah, we have to stop and just laugh.
Was that irony?
We have to stop and just laugh. We have to stop and just laugh. I mean, there's the conservative movement is so obsessed with Barack Obama as an individual that it is beyond the pale. I mean, down to, you know, sort of going over what clothes he wears at any given point. But there you go.
I'm optimistic about our chances because the left isn't just out of ideas. They're out of touch. Take Obamacare, not literally, but figuratively here, okay? We now know that this law will discourage millions of people from working. The left thinks this is a good thing. They say, hey, this is a new freedom, the freedom not to work. I don't think the problem is too many people are working. I think the problem is not enough people can find work.
Now let's pause it here, because now we've talked about this in the past. Even the audience is confused by what he's saying here, because we know that the CBO report showed that Obamacare is going to allow a couple of million people, maybe 2.5 million people over the next 10 years to leave the workforce voluntarily because they will not be locked in a job because they cannot get health insurance. This will then open up these jobs for other people. And the idea, you know, I'm sure there are people in the audience going, hey, wait a second. We're going to have more of an option as to whether or not to work. And that we're talking about mostly people in their late 50s, early 60s, who will have this opportunity. And you got to remember, you know, 10 years out from now, about 10 years out from now, full retirement age will be at 67. So you're talking about people maybe even in their mid-60s, 65-year-olds, who will be able to say, you know what, I don't have to work full-time right now. I can leave the workforce. And no one can complain with that. And he doesn't do quite enough job of conflating those two concepts that people can actually give a full-throated clap. So they get this sort of anemic, like, yeah, I know this is an applause line. All right, but let's get to the meat of his comment.
The more exciting part, even.
Indeed.
If that's possible.
And if people leave the workforce, our economy will shrink. There will be less opportunity, not more. The left is making a big mistake here. What they're offering people is a full stomach and an empty soul. The American people want more than that.
They'd rather have an empty stomach.
You know, this reminds me of a story I heard from Eloise Anderson. She serves in the cabinet of my buddy, Governor Scott Walker. She once met a young boy from a very poor family. And every day at school, he would get a free lunch from a government program.
I have no doubt that someone in Scott Walker's cabinet met a poor child only once.
Go. Well, she tripped over him when she was looking at her smartphone and he was on the street.
He told Eloise he didn't want a free lunch. He wanted his own lunch, one in a brown paper bag, just like the other kids. He wanted one, he said, because he knew a kid with a brown paper bag had someone who cared for him. This is what the left does not understand. We don't want people to leave the workforce. We want them to share their skills and their talents with the rest of us.
Through sharing paper bags.
Now, of course, here, people are confused again. Wait a second. What has this got to do with it? If someone has the ability to leave the workforce, that means that they have the ability to feed their children. And
I'm still stuck on the fact that sometimes, you know, we'll put my older son's lunch in sort of this, you know, little package thing with, you know, an ice pack in it to keep it cool, but we don't put it in a paper bag.
Well,
so I'm starting to worry now that he thinks we hate him.
All right. I just can't believe that he just said that if you can't afford to give your kid lunch, you don't care about your kid.
Yeah,
that's
continue.
Just disgusting.
We'll deal with this as a whole in a moment.
People don't just want a life of comfort. They want a life of dignity. They want a life of self-determination. A life of equal outcomes is not nearly as enriching as a life of equal opportunity.
All right. So
I don't know what else to say. Does he mean the equal opportunity that comes with his going to high school and college on my dime? Or does it come with the equal opportunity that comes with his parents making all their money on contracts given to them by the government in Janesville, Wisconsin, so that he can live the life he's lived where he's never had a non-government paying job or wingnut welfare paying job in his entire life? That's kind of what I'm wondering, this guardian of the free market.
Well, but you know,
he's unbelievable.
Aside from just the general sociopathy here, first off, you know, he's saying that people don't want equal outcomes. You know what? That kid was asking for an equal outcome. He was saying that I want my parents to have the ability to provide me with that lunch on a daily basis in a brown paper bag. I mean,
cutting income taxes on high earners.
And beyond that, there's built into this notion is the idea that, you know, you're getting that free lunch is preventing you from getting that lunch from your parents. It's as if the idea, you know, it's like, you know, if you get subsidized housing, that's preventing you from living in the penthouse in a luxury apartment. This is absurd. It's absurd.
Yep.
And really, you know, even more so, what he is making the argument for here. And of course, the irony is just dripping and the notion of like, you know, these are the guys who want to cut food stamps. which allow for kids to go to school with their own
food stamps, unemployment insurance, you know, health care that's being given, health care subsidies given to people, which also allow them to have free preventative checks and the rest. I mean, anything that could allow that family to not be in debt and to save enough money to be able to pay for that lunch is what these people want to cut. That's why I say he's just such a little swarmy asshole. I mean,
He's not the first person to point out this dynamic, I got to say. I've heard a lot of this before. Let's play it. Let's play this clip. Tell me if this doesn't resonate with you.
Ice cream.
No, it'd be one kid on the side, they get no ice cream, and kids don't care. They go,
you don't have no ice cream. You didn't get none. You didn't get none. You didn't get none. You didn't get none.
Cause your father's an alcoholic.
You can't afford it. You can't afford it.
other kids want to join
live?
In. You can't afford Pike. It. You can't afford it. And his father is an alcoholic. He wants some ice cream. He wants to eat some of my ice cream, but want to lick?
Psych.
Psych. You want some ice cream. You want some ice cream.
Now, of course, Paul Ryan would say, that kid doesn't get any ice cream, but, of course, he has the dignity.
Oh, I had that whole
I'm
thing
not getting
memorized,
a free ice
man,
cream.
In the 80s. I used to love that.
Paul Ryan would even offer the kid the psych lick.
Now,
I know. That is
one
the Republican.
Lick psych.
Go ahead.
And
yeah, I mean, that's the Republican theory of life right there. Eddie Murphy when he's being funny. That was perfect.
And we should also note that what Paul Ryan is making an argument here is universal free lunch. I mean, if we want to rid the stigma of kids getting a free lunch, then you offer a free lunch to everybody at the school. That's the way you get rid of that stigma. You make a free lunch universally.
It's a great point. It's the reason why, you know, conservatives are always trying to do things with means testing of programs like Medicare and Social Security.
That's right.
They want to create that stigma.
That's right. At the same time, he will call for means testing on Social Security or on Medicare. The reason why they don't say that people are stigmatized and don't have their dignity when they get Medicare is because everybody gets it. And
that's right.
And let this be a lesson for those who want to means test something like Social Security or Medicare in that way, aside from it not saving any money from a policy standpoint, and aside from the fact that you can easily do this by taxing up front the payments into these things, they want to stigmatize people.
He's it's hard to control myself because he's such a fraud. I mean, this is one of the, you know, Paul Krugman has done a lot, but I'd say that one of his largest contributions to our public conversation was being a man of real numbers and understanding economics and literally tearing Ryan apart constantly, as he just did again, and pointing out that this guy is a fraud, that he is not a numbers guy, that he's pulled something over on, you know, sycophants in the media on the right and in the mainstream media and others who just don't get the numbers. I would respect him more if he would just stand up there and say, if you don't have lunch, that's your problem. That's not government's role, right? But what I can't stand is this complete sophistry where he gets up and he acts like, you know, that by taking things away, we can make things better.
Right.
And actually tries to have that make sense and has these crowds cheering as if what he's doing is compassionate, as if what he's doing will make things better. And what government's doing is actually hurting people. It's sickening. And it's sickening even more when it's a guy who, again, went to high school and college that we paid for, which I'm glad to pay for his high school and college, not him specifically, but those who need it. But that he has benefited so much from government programs and from government contracts and from government paychecks, and yet this person can sit there and say the things he's saying. He's sickening.
Yeah, and you know, just to pivot on one of the things he said at the top of his speech, this idea of individuals. I don't know if Paul Ryan has seen every conservative pundit and every conservative lawmaker and every Republican lawmaker who's gotten on television and talked about how manly Vladimir Putin is, and how he's stroking a tiger with no shirt on and shaving his chest or whatever it is that he's doing.
Those slightly drooping boobs of his are so hot.
And meanwhile, this fembot, Barack Obama, is just sitting back and allowing, you know, just oozing weakness. And so that Putin decides now's the time for me to strike at Crimea because, you know.
Right.
Obama's getting a manicure or something, or a pedicure.
As Tommy, I don't know if you've ever met Tommy Christopher of Mediaite, who sent out a great tweet earlier where he just said only one word for this: overcompensation. And it was the picture of Mitch McConnell holding up the gun.
Yeah.
I mean, that is literally, that's the Republican Party. They are the party of overcompensation. Really, they're scared little children who aren't smart enough to figure out the complexities of the world hiding under their bed sheets. So because of that, they need guns and they need to launch bombs at people and they need conspiracy theories because, you know, and to believe in superstitions because figuring things out that are nuanced and complex would be a little too difficult and a little too frightening.
Oh, God. All right.
We've got
hold on.
Started.
I just got a story that apparently just came out. Catherine Thompson over at TPM is reporting that the Washington Post, Glenn Kessler, had looked into the tale of the of this woman, Louise Anderson, who told of this boy, this poor boy that she met, who wanted a, who felt that even though he was getting free lunches, he had a full stomach, but an empty soul. Glenn Kessler gave it four Pinocchios because Anderson presented it out of context. He found that Anderson told the story at a 2013 congressional hearing that Ryan chaired and claimed she had spoken to the boy herself. But apparently, her story closely paralleled an exchange from a book called The Invisible Thread, in which an executive offers to give young homeless panhandler money to eat for the week or else make lunch for him for each day. The boy insists on having his lunch made for him in a brown paper bag because that means somebody cares about him. This story is a complete lie!
Which, like, what's
new here,
right?
It has nothing to do with
right?
school lunch whatsoever. Nothing to do with school lunch.
Nothing to do with school lunch. Nothing to do with getting a free lunch, because in both instances, the lunch is going to be provided for this person. It is just that getting the lunch from home creates an emotional attachment. If that's the case, then Paul Ryan should either be advocating for A, universal free lunch to not stigmatize kids, or B, direct payments to these families to provide lunch for their kids.
And that Scott Walker aide didn't even trip over a kid on school lunch.
Right.
She never even spoke to him.
She heard about a guy who wrote in a book a story.
Who knew a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy
who
knew
a poor homeless
kid. Who knew a poor freaking kid, all right? Give me a break. Jesus.
The author of the book.
These guys should just tell more of these stories.
The author.
There was once this young orphan. Her name rhymed with Manny.
Yes.
And this guy is this billionaire Republican out of the kindness of his heart. His name rhymed with Fatty Darbucks. Took her in. And after that, she was able to live a great life because the Republicans are compassionate. And oh, wait, we took that from somewhere? I mean, do these guys, I mean, they get this from Rand Paul's Wikipedia site?
I remember when we were, I was at a homeless shelter providing meals, and one young boy, a blondish boy, came up to me and said, "Please, sir, may I have some more?" And I said, "Of course you can." All right.
And
well,
I turned to him and I said, "Never before has a boy asked for more."
All right, let's.
I knew an old woman. She lived in a shoe.
I couldn't even imagine how lazy Paul Ryan is. He can't even make up his own fake story.
I know. Next time he's getting up, he's like, "There once was a man from Nantucket."
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
Now, I couldn't help but notice that Isabel's singing along. Does your family sing that? Do your boys sing that song to you?
They don't know it. It's very hard for me not to sing it when it's playing, and that just burst out of me.
And
I was singing it in my head, and then it just went audible.
And why do your boys not listen, know that song?
I don't know. I don't know. I guess I've not shared it with them.
Huh. So they
but
don't
I
listen
tried
to, the show.
To play it what about, for my friend the other day.
What do you mean you tried?
We had no internet.
Oh, well, that would make it difficult unless you had downloaded a show onto your phone via the app.
But not even on the phone did I have internet.
What about your husband? He must sing it to you then.
Peter learned how to play guitar because of it.
Are you
so
serious?
He can strum it to me.
Oh, that
no,
would
but
been,
wouldn't that be funny?
That would be really impressive.
I know. I'd love it.
He should do that for your birthday.
I just sing it. What?
He should do that for your birthday.
He should. Or maybe we should, I mean, I don't know. I think I might have to bust it open to the kids. I never really want to expose them too much to my life.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that.
I don't think they've ever watched a episode of Law and Order.
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, that's a little bit different. I mean, you know, you don't show them this sort of like, it's a lot of like angst in that. This is a celebration of you.
I know, and I talk about them a lot.
Yeah.
So they might as well just hear the song.
Well, Peter, at the very least,
I'm going to do it this afternoon.
All right, good enough.
They're out.
They're out? What are they doing? Going to camp?
Yeah, they're doing their, you know, daily routine. They're sailing right now.
Yeah, Isabel is up in Maine.
I'm in Maine.
The
great state of Maine,
right?
Yeah, I could see my parents right now.
Wow. Well, that's
my mother turned 75 yesterday, and my father's 80, and they're like 60-year-olds because they live in Maine.
What do you mean they're like 60-year-olds because they live in Maine? You mean it's given them
it revitalized them.
Wow. Even through
it
those
really
winters,
did.
Huh?
Sorry?
Even through the winters.
Oh, yeah. Well, my father is a selectman of the island.
Well, I had no idea.
Yeah. So he's still into politics. You know, he always is into politics.
Right.
And he was like, okay, I'll grow where I'm planted and just run for office here on an island. And
oh, my God.
Then he's the head selectman.
I just figured out what I want to do.
Retire to an island in Maine and become a selectman?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good way to go.
Hey, get your dad's pre-endorsement. So what are you doing? So when is your book coming out? It's coming out in September, right?
It's coming out September 2nd, everyone.
Wow.
September 2nd. Now, remember you're always so generous to mention it, but I'm always like, it's so far away. It's in a month.
Wow. And so this is appropriate for...
it's almost Myla.
Okay, so for tweens, right?
Tweens.
So what does that mean?
Tweens and young teens. It's because it's about falling in love, but it's like it's romantic. It's not like
10, 11, 12, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds?
Yes. Yes to all of the above.
And so Michael's already bought an advanced copy.
Yeah, I'm right there.
You have?
Of course. I'm putting my Bates education to work, Isabel.
Oh, come on.
Well, I don't know
Wait,
why.
Do you want to hear what
so
Kirkus said about it?
Who?
Kirkus.
Oh, what did Kirkus say about it?
I'm going to do the quote because I got a quote today from it.
We may not even have you on before the book comes out again. So this is it. This is the big plug.
Are you serious?
Well,
this is it? This is the plug?
Well, no, maybe we'll have to do it. I think we'll get in right under the radar, as it were.
Okay, ready? This is the quote. An authentic look at teen love and betrayal that will entertain and touch young readers.
Wow.
Kirkus.
I bet you Myla would like to read that. She doesn't necessarily... Wait, you want to put Thomas on?
Yeah. Okay, but you want to be on the radio for 2 seconds?
Yeah, this is high-quality
stuff.
Sam. Hello, Thomas. How are you?
Good.
How is your summer going?
Good.
Have you ever heard your mother's theme song?
No.
You want to hear it now?
Sorry?
Do you want to hear your mom's theme song right now?
I guess.
Yeah, why not? Well, let's hear it. You ready?
Okay.
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
Now, Thomas, give me your reaction to that. What does it make you think about your mom now that she has a theme song?
It's cool.
All right. That sounds about right to me. All right. Well, you should get Peter to learn that on the guitar and play it to her.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Boy, am I great with kids. Isabel, you there?
Sorry?
That was inspiring.
Thomas? Wait. Yeah, let's put it. Let's put your bomb back on.
Okay, wait. I have to put you back.
What?
Okay, peace.
Peace.
Wait, aren't you Hugo and Bob's Burgers?
I am, actually. That's right.
Yes.
You
give him
excited?
Give him a little Hugo.
You want a little Hugo?
Sorry? Yes, please.
Hello, Bob.
Yes.
There you go. Oh, wow. Yeah, this is definitely worth it.
You are good with kids, just not as Sam Cedar.
Hello, Thomas. I see you're not keeping your burger place clean. All right. All right, put your mom back on. There's more of that where that came from, buddy.
See ya.
Yeah. So long. Wow.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thank you.
Hello.
Wow, I gotta say, your son was more impressed with me than he was your theme song.
I know. Well, I told you he's obsessed with Bob's Burgers.
Well, there you go.
What did you say at the end? Because he flushed.
I said, hello, Thomas. Get your burger shop clean. It's one of the classic Hugo lines.
And did he? Because he was like, yes, he like turned bright red.
Wow, that's great! I'm so excited. I have that power. I mean, I was once on the street with Mila when we ran into Caroline Ray, and I was talking to her. Mila was like, "Let's go, Dad." And then Caroline turned to Mila and said, "Do you watch Phineas and Ferb?" And she said, "Yes." And then she started talking like the mom because she's the mom on Phineas and Ferb, and Mila almost passed out. She was so excited.
Well, Phineas and Ferb is amazing. I love Phineas and Ferb. Let's sing the song to Phineas and Ferb.
No. But I think your son just had that experience with me, is my point.
He totally did because he didn't know. You know, he just came in the kitchen. I was like, here, get on the phone. And then I whispered, he's the guy from Bob's Burgers. And he was like, oh, my God, wait a minute. Freaked out.
There you go.
That was fun. You made his day, man.
All right. Here is... All right, we have two sounds here. Now, as you know, Alex Jones is the purveyor of all secret truths. And when he is not out sending his minions to debunk the fact that 26 people and 20 kids were killed in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, he is also raising money to spread the truth. But sometimes he is lucky to stumble on the real truth, which also just happens to make him money. I would say he stumbles on that almost 100% of the time. But here, we've got it. Let's go. Let me just cue this up. This is Alex Jones now with a video camera just going around his office, just completely impromptu.
I've been slightly depressed, and this has actually helped out a lot. And
well, you hadn't told me that.
Well, Gucci already noticed that I wasn't my usual self. And
all right, pause it. Now he's just going around. He's just going around. He just runs into Shane Steiner, who's a fitness gun enthusiast. Works, I think, at InfoWars Life Central. I don't know. I'm not even sure where he's wandering around. But go ahead.
I'm telling you, I'm already starting to feel a whole lot better.
And he did say, you know, I'm trying to go back into the gym and everything.
Yeah.
I said, well, just try this. And he was like, well, I don't know, you know, is it good? And I said, yeah, give it a try.
This is completely candid. You weren't even going to be.
No, I wasn't even going to be in this.
Okay, well, Shane was just saying, wow, this stuff's really great after like 4 or 5 days. Now you're telling me you mentally, what did it do?
I'm a lot sharper, definitely. Mm. And I'm in a whole lot better mood. And I'm actually wanting to go do some like before pictures to see what over like the next 4 or 5 weeks we'll do.
So you're really going to do this?
I'm really going to do this.
Okay, because, you know, I've known you since high school. You're on the gun show with us. Mm-hmm. And I'm just glad that Gucci already gave you a bottle of that. No, but I was interrupting you earlier. What did you immediately feel when you were doing it, and why do you want to do this?
Well, I was actually just trying it out. I wasn't really expecting anything from it.
Pause
and
it.
After...
This is what is hard. This is hard-hitting investigative journalism that Alex Jones. No, wait a second. Let's go back. So what did it feel like as you ingested this product that we just happened to have around the office?
The video is titled "The War on Male Vitality Exposed: Special Report."
Yes. Okay. Let's go. Continue.
Probably 3 or 4 days. I was in a better mood and I was, you know, wanting to go to the gym.
Steiner, we're going to see what happens in a month and in 2 months. Any final thoughts? And we're doing this.
I guess I'm going to have to start going to the gym now.
The video you just saw was shot on Anthony Gucciardi's iPhone 5 5 weeks ago. And it was totally impromptu. We were talking about the rave reviews we were getting from listeners and viewers about super male vitality.
All right. And now, of course, just coincidentally follows that up with an ad for Super Male Vitality, which, of course, it's completely impromptu. Right?
I don't even know how they put this ad together.
I don't know. This ad just...
There's a sort of spontaneous combustion.
The ad just showed up in my office. That was the first moment when I was like, I recognize that voice in that ad. It sounds like me. Let me go out with a video camera.
It's called Clarus Platform Integration. Oh, excuse me. I say that my mistake.
Let's go out. We're going to check this out. I'm going to find out just what happened. The Superman Vitality. Now, why do you need Superman Vitality? I'll tell you why.
The globalist social engineers are not just targeting us with propaganda. They are manipulating our genetics. We are being targeted at every level by estrogen mimickers that lower our testosterone and other hormones and natural compounds that the body needs. After consulting top doctors, nutritionists, pharmacists, and others, we have developed what I believe is the ultimate non-GMO organic...
Now understand, I have a very busy schedule. So in between coming up with all these fanciful ideas and running, essentially flacking for trying to make people feel powerless about their ability to change things, because, of course, we're run by the Trilateral Commission. I also, in my spare time, go into the garage and I come up with a formula that I help the people from Super Male Vitality come up with. So, in other words, it was completely impromptu that I was finding out how people liked Super Male Vitality, which I just walked into and they were just taking it. So I grabbed their iPhone and I shot it. And also, we came up with these ingredients. In fact, I'm going to do another ad after this ad to allow you the secret in my pamphlet to figure out what I'm talking about here. Go ahead.
Organic Super Male Vitality formula sourced from powerful organic herbs and then concentrated for maximum potency. Super Male Vitality was developed to activate your body's own natural processes instead of using synthetic chemicals. Super Male Vitality by InfoWars Life is so powerful that I only take half the recommended dose for a limited time. We are offering 15% off Super Male Vitality at InfoWarsLife.com to introduce you to this powerful supplement. Visit InfoWarsLife.com today to secure your Super Male Vitality. InfoWarsLife.com.
Now, I know, you might be thinking, that's sort of irresponsible. You only take half dosage, but you, the rest of you, that's because I have so much vitality. If I took the full dosage, I would have super, super male vitality, I'd probably end up having multiple penises.
If I took all the vitality pills, the globalists would just shut this down. There won't be any hope. The response of the trilateral globalist, Clinton Cartel, would shut me down the day I took that supplement.
I'd be able to impregnate so many women at one moment that the globalists would have to shut it down because they'd be afraid of just how vital I was.
There literally would be no more gay fish in the sea. I would reverse that on one full dosage of Super Male Vitality, and if the globalists had that, we'd have to shut it down. And I know I'm risking my life doing this every day, but that would be a certain death sentence for me, and I'm not ready to take that step yet, folks.
Understand. Maybe in the future. Understand that everybody out there who sells a pink tie would be coming after me because, well, all of a sudden males would be so vital. They'd have so much male vitality that you'd never be able to sell a pink tie again.
Barack Obama would sick his pink tie Muslim cartel of the Trilateral Commission. I would not wake up.
This is a 12-minute video, I might add. These were just clips from it.
Right. 12 Unbelievable.
Minutes. Part of it, there's a section where they actually do show the Steiner guys before and after photos. And the before photo is him just like standing there. He's kind of like big guy, but he's got like a beer belly. And then the second one is like
he's ripped. Let me tell you something.
No, he's ripped like...
I want to say one thing right here. if we ever start a MajorityReportLife.com lifestyle choices in selling vitamins.
Oh my God.
I'm asking now. If I have to put money into an escrow fund, but I will pay someone to kill me. And I will put it in escrow. Put the money in escrow just in case I end up ever having to go to
heaven. Or it could be honest. Like, this is the formula I take that keeps me exhausted and aggravated right. most of the day. Hi, I'm Sam Cedar. I feel
good. I want to tell Sam Cedar's going out there. He's selling a super male lack of vitality vitamin supplement, which makes him tired. It has completely shrunk his libido down to something that is almost immeasurable. It
exhausted and completely unable to communicate with his family.
Borderline agoraphobe. The guy can barely pick up the remote to turn on the TV now, so he can barely watch any entertainment. He hasn't been able to open his computer. And he's out there. He's making millions on this super male reducing of vitality.
You will literally feel like you are on a Brooklyn to Manhattan subway at 7:30 in the morning after getting literally 2 hours of sleep.
That's right.
And reading a Social Security Trust Fund report. If you take this supplement, you will have the same feeling Sam Cedar feels throughout the day.
If you're feeling too chipper, head over to my MajorityReportLife.com and take some of that super male lack of vitality supplement.
The globalists are assaulting your testosterone, but in some cases they're not doing quite enough. And if you take the Sam Cedar supplement, you'll have absolutely no testosterone.
Take a look at this before and after shot of Sam Cedar. Notice the color of his hair before taking a super male lack of vitality. And then notice in the after shot, the blue tinge, the blue helmet tinge on his head after taking it. He's completely turned into
a... He just looked like a tired, middle-aged guy before. Now he literally looks like a blue-haired, retired woman in Florida. This is an amazing product, folks.
All right. Let's go to the IMs.
Just love the... This is completely spontaneous. This is just amazing.
Let me say that this mockery of Alex Jones is completely impromptu. Completely impromptu.
We absolutely did not plan this at all in the morning.
We had no idea. No idea. Totally impromptu. No area code. Who's this? Hello?
Oh, sorry. I'm listening on the radio and having on speakerphone. It's a little bit different.
All right.
Okay. This is Jake from Seattle.
Hi, Jake. What can we do for you?
Hi. So I've been listening to your show for a while. And I'm a libertarian. I know you don't like libertarians. I've tweeted you a few times. You told me to call.
Great.
One of my main things is I'm wondering why you hate libertarians. I mean, we agree on half of the issues. Why do you attack? And I understand we disagree on a lot, but we agree on half. Why would you? I'm just curious why you.
I don't hate libertarians.
Dislike.
I think libertarianism is a. Ridiculous ideology. Yes, I may agree with things like the drug war and some aspects of foreign intervention with civil liberties, but it's not. I'm not subscribing to libertarianism. The libertarian economic ideology is a joke. And it's a cruel joke.
I mean, the libertarian ideology, it's based on very fundamental laws of economics that have lasted hundreds of years, right?
Really? Do tell.
Supply and demand.
Do tell. What are those laws?
Whatever you want. What do you want to talk about? You want to talk about...
Well, I want to know what those fundamental laws of economics are.
Well, I mean, if you put, say, a minimum wage is too high, it's a basic price floor, which creates a shortage of jobs willing to be supplied.
Well, actually, are you familiar with the term monosopy?
Sorry, what?
Monosopy?
Monosopping? Yeah. Sorry, I can't.
So yeah, if you put minimum wage too high, you're saying that but you don't have a problem with the minimum wage.
Well, I mean, you do realize that 97% of Americans make over the minimum wage, right? Over the federal minimum wage.
Okay, I'm not 100% sure that's accurate, but okay. So do you have a problem with the minimum wage? How many states
have minimum wages that are higher than
okay.
the federal?
Okay, so you have no problem with raising the federal minimum wage?
Yes. This is the thing, Sam. I think I'm okay with a lot of the quote-unquote liberal issue, you know, policies that you have. I just don't think they should be implemented on a federal level. If you want to implement them on a state level
Why?
Or a local level...
How does that change the fundamental laws of economics?
Because the federal government can't control every individual. It's much harder for a big government to do it. I mean, the founding fathers understood that.
We have a federal minimum wage. Wait a second. You're dancing around here. So you want to talk about the minimum wage, and you're saying that the laws of economics say that the minimum wage is bad, but it's okay if the states do it, but not the federal government, because the federal government can't do it, even though there is a federal minimum wage.
Wait, I'm sorry. You said the federal government can't do it because what?
That's what you just said.
I can't. Yes, I said the federal government shouldn't do it. I said it should be left up to the state.
Why?
Right now, why?
Yeah.
Because that's the reason is because that's the purpose. That's how the country was set up. It was meant to be an experiment. Each state could do what it wanted to do, and then other states could learn from that. I live in Washington. We have a fairly high minimum wage. Now, if it works, then other states will follow us. And if it doesn't work, then people can move to Washington and we'll have a booming economy here.
Well, no, wait a second. This whole thing about the states being experiments and that's the way we set up the states? I mean, what? I mean, I think that's certainly viable in some instances. Some laws set it up, like the Affordable Care Act does that, I guess.
The Affordable Care Act.
So you just have on principle a problem with the federal government setting a minimum wage, but not a problem with the minimum wage. And the reason is because you think that the founding fathers set up the states as experiments. I mean, I'm just trying to understand what you're talking about. Because
I personally believe that the minimum wage shouldn't be raised. But the problem is, if you go to the federal government, I have very little say in the federal government. I have a bigger, my vote counts more in my own state, and my vote counts even more in my own county. You agree with that, right? I mean, there's 300 million people in the country. My vote is 1 in 300 million in the country. In this state, I don't know what the population of Washington
okay.
is, whatever, but it's higher.
Right.
And in the local government, it's even higher. So I feel like, if the federal government is trying to raise them, it's a pretty simple concept. If the federal government wages, if they're changing the minimum wage, it affects 300 million people. If my local state or my local government does it, it affects 9 or 10 million people.
Well, by that measure, there shouldn't even be any state laws either, should there? There should only be local town laws. It should go down to the smallest...
Oh, no.
Maybe just a street. Maybe, yeah. No. Maybe it should just be street. You should just have organizations like... neighborhood councils. I mean, that's nice that you feel
well,
that.
Local
I mean, it's
I
nice
mean,
that you feel that that way. But I mean, but so what? I mean, it. What difference does
so,
it make how you
what,
feel
sir,
about?
Are you asking me what? Are you asking me what the federal government should do?
No, I'm asking you why shouldn't the federal government? Just because you don't feel like you have as much of a say as to whether or not everybody gets a minimum wage? Well, that's the way the country was set up. I'm sorry. Maybe we shouldn't have a president, too, according to you. Because you have a much bigger say in who's going
to
be your mayor. I don't get it.
The reason the federal government should not set up high minimum wage or whatever... But I'm getting mail. Is because if they did, it would affect 300 million people. I mean, I don't understand what you don't understand.
Who's delivering you that mail? I hope it's your neighbor. It's not the federal government that's delivering you that mail, is it?
Oh my God. Actually, that was UPS that I got mail from.
Okay.
You're goddamn right.
Yeah.
There you go.
What? So,
all right. So, let me just get this straight. Let me just see if I have the understand what you're saying. The federal government should not set a minimum wage because there are 300 million people in the country and my vote doesn't count as much. And so it should just be left up to the smallest possible, I guess, cohort of government that we have to set minimum wages, except for not that it should be the states, just because that's what I decide it should be. And that's the way you believe.
Right. Well, I mean, like the last time I called, we talked about schooling, and I told you that some people get bad schooling, and you said that they should just move. Well, if you don't like the minimum wage in your state, you can always move to another state. This is from your word. You said that people don't like the government they're living in, they can always move. They don't like the school. You said this last time I talked to you. You said this. This was several months ago. You said, and I quote, if they don't like the school they're in, they can move, which is a ridiculous argument because we all know that people always can't move, especially if they're poor. This is why the government, the bigger government, hurts the poor more than it hurts the rich, because rich people can move. For example, in Seattle, our current
I don't even know what to talk. I don't even know what I don't even know what point you're trying to make here.
I'm jumping all over. You're right. I'll go back to the minimum wage. I'm sorry. I'll go back to the minimum wage. Okay. So the minimum wage. Yes, I'm saying that it should be a state decision, not a federal decision.
And the reason is because
The reason is because it works a lot better. It's a smaller state. Think about
it. What do you mean it works a lot better? Show me the evidence. Show me the evidence that a state-based minimum wage is somehow more effective at doing what than a federal minimum wage.
Okay, well, what's the federal minimum wage more effective at? Causing unemployment?
No. I mean, you're making the argument that a state minimum wage is better than a federal minimum wage, and I'm asking you why. I mean, yes, if every state in the country raised their minimum wage to $10 or $12 an hour, or let's say they put it up to the rise in productivity from where it was in 68 to $15 an hour, that would be, every state did that, then great. And they all indexed it in the same way, but they, I don't understand why
state is better than federal?
Yeah.
Because think about how well, okay, the federal government has 300 million people that it's trying to monitor. A state only has 10 or 15, or maybe sometimes, you know, in California, you guys have, you're in New York, I guess, so you're 24 million or something like that. I don't know.
What has this got to do with the minimum wage? Yes, I understand there are more people in the country than there are in any given state. So?
So if 10,000 people lose their jobs, it's not going to affect the federal numbers.
You're arguing that the minimum wage causes job loss.
Yes. I mean, that's a...
Do you have any evidence to support that? Because your world, where different states...
And write down a supply and demand curve, and then draw a line above it, and you'll see the demand is higher than supply. It's a very simple concept.
I know it's a simple concept, but it's wrong. Your concept of the minimum wage is wrong. Here's two facts I'm going to tell you right now.
Okay.
One is that when employers have a monopoly on a hiring labor, it doesn't work the way you're talking it works. And I want you to write this down. MONOSOPY. And Google it. And the other thing I want you to...
Monopoly? Well, monopoly?
With an S.
I couldn't hear it, so...
MONOSOPY.
Not monopoly.
The other thing I want you to look up is what happens when two states that are contiguous, and one raises their minimum wage and the other one doesn't? Because according to you, we would see job losses in the state that raises their minimum wage versus the state that didn't. particularly the two counties of those states that are right abutting each other on that line. But there's no evidence of that.
Okay, you're right. There is no evidence, hard evidence. But the fact
no,
is...
No,
that
there's
the
no, there's no soft evidence either. In fact, let me just hold on for a second. Let me just quote from Mike Konzel, who wrote a piece the other day. That even in every report of that has been written about the minimum wage, the fact is that none of them cite any type of significant job loss. None of them.
Right, and at the margin, it's not really going to affect it. If you do it right around the equilibrium right now is probably around $8 or $9 an hour. You could probably raise it to $9 an hour.
Okay, so your issue is that now, so let me restate
here.
The federal government should not be raising it to $10. Only states should raise it to $10. Federal government should run it to $9. Nothing you're saying is cohesive, even based on your own logic.
You run a business right now, right? The majority report is a business,
correct.
Right?
Right.
Okay. You probably pay your employees more than minimum wage.
What?
You probably pay your employees. How many employees do you have there, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I have a number of independent contractors, but arguably two.
15?
Two.
Okay, how many?
Two.
I can't hear you.
Okay.
Hang on. I'm going to go back on my computer so that I can try to understand you, because your microphone sucks. You should invest in a better microphone or something.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll let you go. You could try and call back later.
Wait a minute. I mean, I was asking...
Organize your thoughts.
Okay. So...
Whoa, what a train
wreck.
Sorry,
I'm getting the voice now on my computer. Okay. So you employ 10 people, okay?
Okay.
I didn't hear what the number was, but 10 people. Okay. Do you think that gives you expertise? I mean, do you know anything? You run the radio. You know about the radio industry, sure. But do you know anything about how to run a restaurant? Do you know anything about the labor cost of a restaurant?
No, I only know the reports I've seen by economists who say that if these fast food restaurants were to raise the minimum wage to $9 across the board, it would add cents.
Okay, The Economist, wait. Okay, I'm sorry. The Economist, you said, how many of those economists ran a restaurant? How many of those economists ran a restaurant, and how many of those economists were academics? They have PhDs probably.
Have you ran a restaurant? Have you ran a restaurant?
So, yeah. By liberal professors.
Have you ran a restaurant?
Yes, tell me about your restaurant that you run.
I'll tell you what. Sorry, what?
Tell me about the restaurant that you run.
I don't run a restaurant. But
then what are you talking about?
I have talked to people who manage restaurants.
Oh, okay.
I've talked to people who manage restaurants.
I've never talked to anybody in the restaurant business. Okay.
Yeah, economists, when they study wages at restaurants, they never, ever take data from restaurant industry or talk to those people, ever.
But let's hear what your friends
of
who
course.
Run a restaurant say.
Okay, you know, like the woman that just ran, for example, McDonald's, everybody talks about the CEOs that make millions. You are aware that that's a franchise-owned company, meaning that it's small businesses that are running it, right? So raising the minimum wage would only hurt the franchisees, the small business owners?
I would have to be so oxygen deprived to be able to think about what you're talking about right now because you're dancing around the issue. So now you're saying it affects franchisees. Okay, fine. I didn't raise the CEO of McDonald's. You just did. So the franchisee that you've talked to, who owns your buddy, who owns the franchise of the McDonald's, tell me what he said to you.
What? The guy that owns the franchise?
All right, look, I gotta go. Really? Is this even
this is hilarious? This is what everybody should know about libertarians right here.
Dude, you know, how long did you plan to call me? You say you called me a couple of months ago. Did you even think about what you were going to say when you called in?
No, I didn't need to.
Yes, you did.
What you're saying, you make up bullshit facts and...
What facts am I making up that are bullshit?
It's not complicated. You've never worked. You've never talked to these people. You've never worked with these people.
I got news for you, Chief. I worked for 4 years in restaurants.
What?
I worked for 4 years in restaurants.
You worked for restaurants. Okay, you have worked for restaurants. Have you ever managed a restaurant?
No, I have not. Have you?
I haven't managed a restaurant either. I'll say,
okay, then okay, why no, are you raising that as some type of credential to talk about this? What does your friend say?
Okay, I have managed a small shop.
What do you have a degree in?
I've managed a small shop that does not make as much money as a restaurant. And I can tell you right now that things like, you know, in my local government, they want to raise it to $15. I can tell you right now that that would destroy the entire job market.
It would destroy the entire job market.
Then you clearly have never run a business.
Well, you just admitted to me 4 minutes ago that you know I run a business.
That's like literally what this is, buddy.
And I will move if they raise the minimum wage.
Okay.
What you're arguing, though, is you're arguing that the federal government should raise them. You think the federal government should put their hands in it. And you quote these economists. You know, last time I tweeted, you sent me an essay, a really interesting essay on Social Security. They're all written by academics. They're all written by people with PhDs who have never once worked in the actual field.
Your argument is, wait a second, let me see if I get this straight. I'm going to encapsulate this because this is really going nowhere. Your argument is that you believe the state should be experiments. The federal government should not be involved in raising the minimum wage because, A, there are 300 million people in this country, and, B, the only people who have done any research into it are experts who study the field, and you can't trust the intellectuals. You need to trust the people who don't want to pay the minimum wage as to whether or not they can actually afford the minimum wage.
Oh, no.
I have your argument right?
Can we always agree that they're economists? Sorry. Sure, I guess you do. Whatever. We can both agree, though, there's economists on both sides, right? There's Nobel Prize-winning economists. Milton Friedman, Frederick Hayek, James Buchanan.
Did they ever run restaurants, sir?
Were libertarians.
Sir, did they ever run a restaurant?
No,
did Hayek ever run a Denny's?
No,
sir.
Your point is, no, I know your point is. Your point is, just like every other libertarian who calls in, you have ideas that when you're faced with any type of evidence, you say, oh, well, that's hard evidence. But I don't need hard evidence because I can draw a graph.
What are you talking about hard evidence? Let me explain something. Okay, I study mathematics. I'm a senior getting a degree in math and economics. So I understand.
Oh, wait a second. So you're one of those academics I'm not supposed to listen to.
Be manipulated. Do you know how easy numbers can be manipulated? Like, you are so ignorant. You got a degree in government. You literally went to school where they taught you that government was important.
What?
What was your relationship like with your parents?
All right,
what do you
buddy.
Mean?
All right, buddy. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you've made a great argument for yourself.
Go back to school. Learn about economics. Learn about math.
I studied
economics
in college.
Because you don't understand.
As
that.
Soon as I was to go to this university and learn about economics, then you would say you completely don't know what you're talking about because you're just sitting there as an
it
academic.
It is one of those eggheads. All right, look.
Do you, here's, I don't understand. Do you
oh
want
my
to,
God.
Do you,
okay.
You're out of your minds, but here's what I'll promise you.
Look,
I'll
great,
get a PhD in econ. I'll run a McDonald's. And then you'll come up with the next thing to change the subject.
Yeah. Listen, do yourself a favor. Do us both a favor, okay? Because this is just.
I can't change the subject because I can't understand you because you have a shitty microphone. Get a better microphone. Maybe
all right.
You should invest in a better microphone that's made by
Can you hear that? I just hung up on you. Did you hear that? Okay, let's go. That was unbelievable.
I wonder what kind of phone he uses.
I can't believe it. I think I enjoyed that more.
I really found that like just. He couldn't even get past the first sentence of his argument.
No, my favorite was the constant talking over himself. Have you ever run a restaurant? Well, I haven't. You should go to school. I hate academics.
Oh, God.
It was like one after the other.
I know. I just felt that was torturous.
This was a dude, I just have to say, in the first communication to us, when he was trying to do his version of civil, and he was like, now,
you can look this up on Google, or maybe Sam and people he works with use a government search engine whose name I'm not familiar
Wait,
with.
Was this the guy who said that?
You don't want to use Google. Remember that?
I don't remember that guy.
It was like we're all like in some like
oh my god
index cards. Or
Listen,
something.
we want more libertarians to call in, but please bring a topic and information surrounding
look,
that topic.
Yeah, honestly, look, take a piece of paper out and just do your bullet points. Like this is what I want to touch on. I want to touch on this. Like I think the minimum wage set by the federal government is wrong. And then ask yourself a question: why? You can actually write it. Why? Question mark. And then you put an A and you go, the answer is because. Like, this is what I go through with, honestly, with my daughter.
And, you know, when you write things out, you might write out a question like, hey, Sam, do you run a restaurant? And then you'll see it on the paper and say to yourself, oh, wait, I don't either.
Yes, if you're going to say that you cannot talk about these topics, about raising the minimum wage in a restaurant unless you run a restaurant, make sure you run a restaurant.
Also, plan your attack. So if you spend half of your time saying that people with academic training in economics have no credibility, don't then cite your pursuit of a degree in economics as a point of your credibility.
All right, let's go to the IMs. We'll get to more calls in a moment.
I think in the near future, we have to put out a new libertarian challenge with how.
Oh, yeah.
How
yeah,
to.
Yeah, like a handbook.
A libertarian like a handbook.
All right. You were just mentioning that President Obama came out in support of net neutrality insofar as he believes the FCC should reclassify internet service providers under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. You will recall that the Bush administration changed the classification from Title II to Title I back in 2003. The president is proposing putting it back there or suggesting to the FCC. Of course, there's also a problem in that the president appointed a former telecommunications and internet, cable lobbyist, the head of the FCC, so there's a little bit of pushback. Nevertheless, the value of that from a policy standpoint is quite obvious. That is, you cannot allow internet service providers, which have virtual monopolies, even before AT&T and Comcast merge, have virtual monopolies, to basically say, we're going to favor one service on the wholesale level versus another. They've got to be neutral arbiters. They've just got to basically, we provide the pipes, we charge consumers a fee for it, but we're not going to make more money on the back end and dictate what innovation occurs. Well, there's some people who disagree with this concept of net neutrality. One of them is clinically insane. Here's his video.
You see, to recognize that for most Americans, the internet has become an essential part of everyday communication and everyday life. Yeah, this is part of, this has been the plan for a decade. Free, Pause. Quote, Wi-Fi.
Now, when he says this has been the plan for a decade, what he is referring to, I mean, this has been a long time plan for this. Because 11 years ago, it was actually classified that way. And then the Bush administration switched it. So it's been the plan for a decade to go back to the way that the internet was a service that everybody needs. That's a very controversial statement now.
That's paid for by taxpayers, but you have no rights on that Wi-Fi, and you can't get to Infowars.com or DrudgeReport.com. That the White House officials have said they want to shut down, basically.
Pause it.
When?
First of all, net neutrality has nothing to do with public Wi-Fi. I would love public Wi-Fi. In fact, I would love public fiber optic. Unfortunately, net neutrality will bring none of that. So he's gone from just sort of mischaracterizing what it is to full-on lying and conjecture. I have no doubt, though.
Well, net
neutrality. I have no doubt.
Net neutrality.
That the White House, the Illuminati, the White House Illuminati, the Illuminati lights up the White House, wants to shut down Infowars.com. Good.
So this is it. They're coming. Drums, drums, drums of the deep.
Drums, drums, drums of the deep shit.
This is just a high-tech version of what the Soviets and the Nazis and the Chinese communists and Fidel Castro and every other nutball did. Do you think they like the men that bring them to power? You think Hitler did? You think they like having you around, these little cowardly people? They hate you. They want total control because they don't like wealth. They don't like power. They don't like success. Do you think they like strong, hardcore men who've killed a bunch of people? You think they actually like the real instrument? They fear you. They hate you. They shake. They're going to destroy you. So you go ahead and you serve them and you sell your family out and you sell your name out and you sell your soul out because I guess they are God.
Let me say, as a just the idea that we don't like the people who put us in power is so wrong.
You know, the problem that I have with Alex Jones, this is Hitler here, is he's always making everything so personal. And I think that, you know, we can disagree without being disagreeable. You know, it's like the idea that I don't appreciate people who voted for me and took a chance. You know, I had a pretty spotty background, you know, and they still gave me a chance to come to power. You're going to say I don't appreciate that?
But the idea is that we would spit on people who've done us a solid and made us dictator. That's just, can't Alex just do this without being so ad hominem?
I don't, and going to the merits of the issue, I mean, Alex started his own startup as a small-scale, you know, independent voice, and I think he was appreciating neutrality in the fiber optics, and now he is Mr. Big Deal.
Yeah, I think now that I've gotten into the barn, I'm going to close the barn door and no one else gets in. Just Drudge and I.
And, you know,
me and Drudge will be the only ones on the internet. And if they think that you're going to get after them with the strong, hardcore men. Yeah. We love strong, hardcore men.
Love strong, hardcore. And, you know, Alex only brings up my name all the time because I have so many more hits and clicks on YouTube, Facebook, everywhere. And he is just trying to suck off of me because he cannot even approach the level of clicks I get. And that's why he has to attack me as a human being and as a person.
So not, strange.
Not arguing ideas. Alex, why are you so angry?
So strange. Alex seems to have a problem with me. However, he'll put me all over his meta tags. Why might that be? Because you find that I trend higher than you on Google.
I guess for all the conspiracy theories, you are familiar with how to use Google Analytics, I guess. Yeah. This isn't the Illuminati. It's not stopping you from being a savvy businessman. But, you know, when you question the connection I have with my fans, that's when I have to take exception.
They will come, they will suck the male beta vitality out of your system. Literally, what they will do with their Wi-Fi. They will send the beams, the Wi-Fi beams, via net neutrality into your bloodstream. They will, this net neutrality Wi-Fi has the ability to locate the super male vitality beta that you have ingested. It will separate from your, this is it. Now, this is biological stuff. This is all documented. They will separate the super male beta vitality, which, of course, as you know, fuses to your white blood cells, which is what gives you the incredible energy that we have shown time and time again in completely off-the-cuff video testimonials. What the net neutrality Wi-Fi does, it gets in there, it separates your the super male beta vitality from the white blood cells. It makes you a wimpy man. And then, of course, you're not a strong, hardcore man, and that allows the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberger Group to come in. And this has been the plan for many years. So,
that's,
stay
of course,
away.
Why you need, you should do the impression, but the blocker. The net
Which is exactly why you need the net neutrality Wi-Fi blocker. Now, we have developed this through a series of herbs that we have found that were from the Amazonian rainforest, the one place where you cannot actually have Wi-Fi, because it's virtually impossible to string fiber in that area. And we have extracted from the Wi-Fi blocking capabilities. And we now have that now. And we soon we'll have just a completely impromptu testimonial. For instance, Matt, you were telling me today that you could not get the Wi-Fi on your computer or in any part of what you're doing.
No, I mean, it's been completely blocked.
Yeah, completely blocked. Wi-Fi. All right, there you have it.
How's that affect your sex drive?
But at the same time, I've noticed you've been fornicating all over this office.
I mean, he's literally humping the wall. It's completely impromptu. I walked in this morning. Matt's there. He's trying to wedge himself by the bookcase. It's out of control. This is what you get when you get the male vitality, net neutrality blocker.
One of the things you've absolutely got to do is get your wee-wee out of the headphone distribution box. It's part of the reason why I can't hear anything you're saying.
You know, none of these things have been scientifically validated as actually enhancing immune system functionality, which is or testosterone for that matter.
Here's the secret password for our Wi-Fi that we've been planning to send to all of you. So we don't like Jews.
Fans first, because
but
I respect my
fans.
But
use the numeral 3 instead of the E on Jews.
Oh,